Hi, this is Brian Whitmore, host of the Power Vertical podcast. The theme of this week's program, anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny's asymmetrical war with the Kremlin, turned out to be even timelier than we expected. In fact, it was a little too timely for our own good. Several hours after Mark and I recorded the podcast on April 4th, Navalny gave an interview to Dosh TV in which he said in no uncertain terms that he intended someday to run for president.
I want to become president. I want to change life in our country. I want to change the system of governance. I don't want the 100 million people who live here and who have oil and gas running out of the ground to live in hopeless poverty. But I want them to live normal lives, like in a European country.
That, of course, would have figured prominently into our discussion, had it happened before we recorded. But nevertheless, Navalny's political future is a subtext that runs throughout this week's program. So enjoy the podcast.
Суд над Алексеем Навальным пройдет 17 апреля. Алексея Навального поступило в суд...
Киров Лес, один из активистов оппозиции, подозревается в растрате...
...расследовании дела о растрате имущества в компании Киров Лес. Навальный тогда был советником губернатора области Никиты Белых. Вот и
адвокат... Алексей Навальный's battle with the Kremlin is about to enter a decisive round. A court in the Kirov Oblast announced this week that Navalny's trial on charges that he stole 16 million rubles from a state-owned timber company will begin on April 17th. Navalny calls the case ridiculous, but nevertheless says he expects to be convicted and possibly imprisoned for up to a decade. But he is also determined to make this as painful as possible for the Kremlin. Using his signature online tactics, Navalny has gone on the offensive. He has posted all the case materials online on a special website dedicated to the trial, and he has used his blog and Twitter feed to urge the public to make up its own mind about his guilt or innocence. Navalny's immediate fate will be decided in a provincial Russian courtroom, where the outcome is more than likely predetermined. But the enduring part of this saga, the one that will have lasting political implications, will be determined in the struggle to brand, frame, and define him in the public imagination. It's a classic showdown pitting a new media-savvy blogger with a devoted following against the Kremlin's tried-and-true tactics of dealing with dissent. Navalny's looking-glass war is heating up. Where will it lead? Will the authorities succeed in silencing him, or will they only succeed in creating a martyr? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. Kirill Coburn is off this week, but on the Skype line from New York City is my other semi-regular co-host, NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Brian.
Mark, as I said at the outset, the outcome in the Leninsky District Court in the Kirov Oblast, and God, can you fit any more Bolshevik names into the name of a court there than that, is largely predetermined. I'd be shocked if Navalny isn't convicted, as I'm sure you would too. But that's not where I think the real battle is being fought here. We know what's going to happen in court. The Kremlin very much needs to destroy Navalny to convince the public that the man who dubbed United Russia the party of swindlers and thieves is, in fact, a swindler and thief himself. They have the state media and the full weight of the state apparatus at their disposal, but Navalny is no slouch at this PR game. So let's take inventory here. How do these two sides stack up in this looking glass war for hearts and minds? What are their respective assets, do you think?
When we come to this particular form of asymmetric warfare, it's always interesting, as with a guerrilla struggle, that one side has all the guns and the other side sort of has to find ways of basically shifting the battle, which is, you know, how you framed it. There's no doubt that the authorities have the ability to basically create whatever kind of court result that they want. The question is, again, how much damage that they can sort of absorb doing so. I assume, and in some ways we might be giving them too much benefit of the doubt, I assume they feel they have a pretty watertight case. Not one that would stand up in a Western court, but at least one that, after it's been suitably presented and massaged, at least is going to make this not look like the most ridiculous kangaroo court, because they will have half an eye on what the outside world is saying. So, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of, you know, additional documents and sort of insinuations being presented. What I think is the uncertainty, because we know what the authorities have got, basically. The uncertainty is what Navalny has got. Now, it's all very well being in the right. It's all very well being media savvy and so forth. The thing is, though, the media only sort of, new media, shall we say, only matters so long as it's constantly being presented and represented. The danger is that today's cause célèbre becomes tomorrow's lost story. So, I mean, I think from Navalny's point of view, it's going to be, in some way, he's going to be the Soviets in the first start of World War II. He can't beat the attack. He can just make sure that he sort of makes it as painful and as slow as possible. So, I mean, I think the thing about Navalny is we're going to see if he has stamina, first of all. We're talking about him and his support base of bloggers and other sort of enthusiasts. So, first of all, does he have stamina? Secondly, does he have a narrative that can go beyond the people who are already supporting him? I mean, I think the key thing is for him just as with Pussy Riot, the court case became the point at which they were able to reach out to wider constituencies and audiences, some of whom ended up hating them, some of whom ended up loving them. But nonetheless, it actually changed them from being an essentially very small-scale metropolitan kind of group that was talking to the same audience to suddenly becoming a national phenomenon. Well, this court case, obviously, Navalny is more of a national phenomenon. But nonetheless, this court case also offers him the platform to actually create his own narrative and frame himself as the sort of the victim of the new age. The final point I throw in is, yeah, we know what the outcome is almost certainly going to be in terms of that he's going to be found guilty. What we don't know is actually what they're going to do to him. Because I think in many ways, if there's any subtlety or wits in the Kremlin, they're not going to put him in prison. They're actually going to give him a suspended sentence, which means that he's disqualified from standing for political office. But on the other hand, he's not, wearing that. Exactly. He's not a martyr. He's not somewhere out there. He's still sort of in cafes, and they can say, look, he actually got off very lightly, considering that he was a corrupt individual.
Right. And he made this very point in an interview with Moskovsky Komsomolets last week. And he has made no secret of the fact that he does want to run for election to the Moscow City Duma, where there'll be elections later in the year. How do you think Navalny, because I was preparing for this podcast and writing a blog this week on this case, I couldn't help but think of previous cases where the Kremlin put away their villain of the moment. Hodorkovsky is the obvious comparison or contrast. You mentioned Pussy Riot. How does Navalny stack up as in terms of the image he presents to the public in comparison with somebody like Hodorkovsky or other oligarchs that they've driven into exile, such as Gusinski or Berezovsky? How does he stack up against Pussy Riot, for that matter, in terms of a villain who they did manage to put away? Is he sufficiently an attractive enough figure, or can they turn him into an odious enough figure? I mean, we've watched this man for a while now. We kind of have a good sense of his public persona. How do you think it stacks up?
I think Navalny is a far, far more dangerous enemy/victim for the state than any they've taken on so far. Hodorkovsky, well, to an extent, while in prison, he has managed to kind of reinvent himself as this liberal martyr. But, at the time, he was just one more of these arrogant, get-rich-quick oligarchs. I think very, very few people shed many tears for him. Pussy Riot, okay, a very different case, but on one level, despite the dignity that they showed in court, it was easy to say, look, these are first of all, look what they're doing and desecrating our churches, but also essentially these are just purveyors of discordant music who are sort of in it just for the publicity. Navalny has the key virtue of first of all, he's already had a chance to craft his narrative. He's not someone who is going to come out of nowhere for most people's consciousnesses. Secondly, there's no particularly high vulnerability sort of point, I think. Yeah, they're going to try and suggest that, look, he's a hypocrite because he's been stealing 10,000 metric tons of timber and he's on the Aeroflot board and so forth. These are fairly unimpressive charges, to be perfectly honest. There's nothing especially sexy or grabbing about it. And we know that precisely Navalny and his, again, in this case, it's even more importantly, his supporters will be pushing back. It's going to be a contested narrative, which, again, is very different from, if we say, Khodorkovsky, where at which point basically the narrative was crafted and just sort of dumped out there in the media. So I think for all kind of reasons, this is going to be very, very different because of who Navalny is. But also, last point I want to throw in at this point is, I think also because it reflects the beginnings of a proper maturation of the opposition. I mean, it was interesting that precisely Navalny was talking about standing for office. We've seen the political opposition, the sort of the hipster elite, spinning their wheels for the last year and a bit. They've not really known which way to go. They've not really found a way of reaching out to a wider Russia. And I think the very fact that Navalny is actually now beginning to look at actually getting involved in the boring nitty-gritty type of politics and standing for office and so forth, I think is important. And this could actually, therefore, this court case could also be a key catalytic point for that opposition to give them that re-energization, because they really have, I think, definitely lost their mojo in the last time.
So the authorities could really shoot themselves in the foot, and that brings to mind something else. I mean, a way the authorities have done Navalny a favor. It didn't look like it at the time, but if you remember back when the apartment raids of the opposition leaders in Moscow, as a result of that, and those were televised, and we're going to talk a little bit about this tactic in the second half of the program, but when I saw Navalny's apartment, my first thing that jumped into my head as I was watching this raid was, my God, the man lives in a fairly modest apartment. I mean, for somebody of his, of his fame and stature, he lives like what looks like an ordinary Moscovite in an ordinary residential district of Moscow. And he made this point himself in his interview with Moskovsky Komsomolets, where he said, you could see everything I do. I live in a modest apartment. I've lived in the same apartment my whole life. My kids go to ordinary schools. I drive an ordinary car. If I stole all this money, where is it? Right. Mm. And what jumped out at me there was he's almost trying to present himself. He even used the phrase, this is the life of an ordinary Muscovite. So if maybe it's a stretch to present Navalny as the Russian everyman, I don't think it's much of a stretch to present him as the Muscovite everyman. Do you think he can't, the virtue he has that Khodorkovsky didn't have, even the Pussy Riot didn't have, is that he can say, I am you. Would you agree with that?
Yes, to an extent. I mean, it may be the apartment of an ordinary Muscovite, but it's an ordinary Muscovite of the middle or better class and so forth. I mean, I think probably he's still not at the point where he can actually talk to your sort of Omsk truck driver,
right?
On the same terms. But then again, who can? I mean, within the political classes. But certainly, I very much agree with that point, that this is not a man who has evident weak points for the authorities to exploit. This is not a man whom they can actually point to his Bentley and say, ha, think of this tribune of the people now, or whatever. And the more light they shed upon him, his lifestyle, his activities and so forth, they presumably are hoping that they can sort of, by innuendo and hint, imply terrible things are going on behind the surface. But actually, the more light they shed on him, the more that they give the chance for him precisely to reach out to people and say, look, actually, yes, I'm a Muscovite, yes, I'm educated and so forth, but I'm certainly not like these exploitative so-and-sos. Who are after me.
Now, another thing that jumped out at me is that up until now, Navalny's been great at offense. I mean, he branded, famously branded United Russia the party of swindlers and thieves. And that is one of the most amazing one-man marketing campaigns, guerrilla marketing campaigns I've ever seen. I mean, that thing came out and within months, it was a buzz phrase throughout Russia. It was literally amazing. Without control, without any access to broadcast media, he managed to do that, which is a testament to the power of the internet. He dubbed Alexander Bastrykin his arch nemesis, the foreign agent Bastrykin, and just turned this into a meme on Twitter. But that got out there. I mean, that really got out there. Pecting is another, buzz phrase he got out there for after Vladimir Pektin, the Duma deputy who was forced out due to his property holdings in Miami. Navalny coined that phrase. He's been great at offense. He's been great at defining the regime. How good do you think he's going to be at defining himself?
That is one of the big uncertainties. I I suspect that actually he will continue to do what he's good at, which is precisely relying on offense. Because, I mean, you know, we saw that, I mean, you cited that Moskovsky Komsomolets interview, in which he was clearly trying to frame himself.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, he's clearly aware of the need to do so. But to be honest, I think it would be a mistake for him to shift the focus onto himself. He wants to make the other side have to make all the allegations and all the claims and hope that, in fact, they overreach themselves. He's not going to be able to defend himself effectively just by simply saying, I'm a nice guy. Yes, sure, people might think, oh, he seems to be a nice guy. But I don't think that actually has any particular sort of powerful impact. I think he needs to really continue with what he's been doing already. Because if he can present the authorities as being precisely this corrupt party of thieves and exploiters, then by definition it sanctifies him as being their enemy. They have chosen to make him their enemy. They're the ones doing all the running. There's something slightly pathetic about just simply sort of moving on to the defence when you've been such an effective offence player up to that point. So we'll wait and see. And in a way, the natural process of the court gives him that structure for crafting his own defence, because, you know, he will have a defence and he will be responding, and or his legal team will be responding to charges made. But I think that he's one of these people who tends to move forward rather than entrench himself.
I mean, you mentioned the nice guy factor, and I mean, I've never met the man, but I've been watching him in public for a while, and he does come across as a nice guy. He comes across very engaging. He comes across very funny. If you watch him interviewed, he's hilarious. He's had me in stitches a few times. I just recall one interview on Deutsche TV when he had just branded Bastrykin, the foreign agent Bastrykin, and he was being interviewed by a presenter on Deutsche TV, and they mentioned Bastrykin, and he said, "Stop, look. We have a law in the Russian Federation that says anybody with assets abroad is a foreign agent. So if you want to follow the law, you must refer to him from now on, please, as Foreign Agent Bastrykin." Okay, you know, and it was just perfectly deadpan delivered. You know, he had his tongue in his cheek, of course, but he's very good at this. So I wouldn't downplay the nice guy image. Do you think these things could make it very difficult for the Kremlin to vilify him?
Yes, I do. It's not that I'm downplaying the nice guy. It's that I don't think it should be or it will be a key element of his strategy. I mean, that's just going to come through. Like it or not, the Kremlin has now ensured that he will have a lot of media attention. And, you know, even on mainstream channels. And, okay, we know that they have a tendency to sort of use those for character assassination, but it becomes harder when someone's character is not so sort of geared to that. So I think he's definitely going to be a harder nut for the authorities to crack in that respect. But as I said, I mean, for me, I wouldn't be surprised if, in a way, he relies on his natural characteristics for his defence. But if he's going to really make this work for him, he has to inflict some serious wounds in the process. So I think this is why, actually, it is a case in which offense is the best defense.
Now, what about, I mean, the evidence in the case, and this is, I mean, he's, again, I'm referring to this Moskovsky Komsomolets interview repeatedly because it was very extensive and I thought very telling. He said, basically, look, this, because the journalist asked him, isn't this case going to be too complicated for the public to understand? And you're trying to present your innocence, but they, you know, guilt by innuendo, they're going to win this battle. And he said, no, look, anybody will get this. It's simple arithmetic. This is not the Khodorkovsky case. This is and all of the prosecution's evidence is also my evidence. The defense evidence and the prosecution evidence is identical. I put it all online and say, you could read this. You could look at all the accounting. You could look at the FSB wiretaps of me. It's all there online. And anybody with two brain cells to rub together, he didn't use that phrase, that's mine. He said anybody with education will be able to figure out what happened here. And I'll have to admit, if you look at this case, the Kirov-Les case, and it's surprising, if this is the best they got on him, I mean, this is they don't have anything. Because this it's pretty amazing. And even somebody who is not favorably disposed toward Navalny is going to look at this case and say, So I don't know. If you look at even the pure merits of the case, which is supposed to be the Kremlin's strong suit here, do they look even weak there?
Yes, very much so. And I think, therefore, it's worth slightly sort of pivoting to think about something about the domestic internal political context. we've known for a long time, just as Navalny has known for a long time, that the Kremlin, or more to the point, Bastrykin, head of the investigations committee, is after him. And, you know, Bastrykin is, he was the one who basically told his investigators who had dropped this case, it's time to pick it up again and see what you can make of it. But also, you know, he's been peering under every single stone he could imagine, hoping to find that wonderful bit of dirt that he could use against Navalny. And he's obviously failed. He's had to come up with this reheated case that has already been deemed not worthy of investigation, not worthy of prosecution, and they haven't come up with anything. Now, you know, barring there's going to be some 11th hour revelation, what it seems to be at the moment is desperation. Bastrykin is one of these figures who basically had staked, I wouldn't say quite staked his career, but staked a lot of his political capital on the fact that he could bring down Navalny. And I suspect there was a degree of impatience. Bastrykin doesn't have much support within the inner Kremlin elite himself. And I think there comes a point where sort of more or less you're expected to put up or shut up. I must admit, I was actually surprised that they went with this now. I thought they would precisely be holding on to the option of prosecuting Navalny for when they actually found something worth prosecuting him for. The very fact that they've decided to move with this extraordinarily weak case, for me, implies that it's a case where sort of Bastrykin feels he's in a position where he has to throw the dice regardless.
And they have other cases they've allegedly prepared against him, one about that he fleeced some cosmetics company, another that, and these all look just as flimsy as the Kirov-Les case, another that he illegally privatized a distillery while working as an advisor to Nikita Bielik as governor of Kirovsky Oblast. And the funniest one of the bunch is that he embezzled money from a political party. The party no longer exists, and the members of the party said no money was embezzled from the party. So the alleged victim even denies that a crime's going on. If you look at the Kirov-Les case, one of his co-conspirator was previously somebody that was testifying against him. They've dropped the case numerous times. This all looks really flimsy. And the other point I'd like to make is, going back to the Khodorkovsky thing, 2013 is not 2003. The Russian public is a lot more savvy now. Then they might have been able to put a Navalny away in 2003. 2013, I'm not sure they can even put away Khodorkovsky right now. It's the context has changed dramatically. Would you agree?
Yeah, very much so. And that context is not just about sort of, the objective conditions of the Russian people. It's also about the amount of political capital that the Kremlin has got, which we know is far, far less than then. But also precisely the wider issue of, you know, this is an age of social media in a way that 2003 wasn't. And what's more, this is an age in which actually the opposition has already been working, and particularly Navalny, has already been working very assiduously on building those social network avenues for getting the word out. I mean, you mentioned just how good a guerrilla marketer he's proven to be. So, I mean, I think for all these reasons, on the one hand, you've got a very weak case. Secondly, you actually have a Kremlin with far, far less credibility than before. And in that respect, you know, whether or not people supported or disagreed with the Pussy Riot trial, nonetheless, it has created a context in which people are thinking that, in fact, court cases are political. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, he's a beneficiary of that. Then the third issue is that precisely the nature of the target. This is not a man who enriched himself obscenely. This is not a man who, again, you know, sang obscenely. Instead, this is a man who is precisely heading after corrupt officials. And quite frankly, what Russian who's not a member of the inner upper elite would not get behind a campaign to basically name and shame corrupt officials?
I mean, I'm almost going, this could turn into a perfect storm that could turn into a catalyst for the opposition movement. This trial could. I mean, in a way that the Pussy Riot trial almost was, but not quite. I mean, it seems all of the elements seem to be in place for this to be a super catalyst or not.
It's funny. I think so. Because let's think about it. I mean, the opposition seemed to emerge from nowhere with the castling. That was that one point that made enough people think, no, this is not right. We do actually have to make our voices heard. It's quite astonishing if you think just how quickly that movement coalesced, how quickly it could get massive crowds on Bolotnaya and so forth. So it's actually proven reactive. It tends to require some great sort of push from the Kremlin. It's really, really annoy the public. Well, so too, this Navalny case, I mean, I think, again, it has all the potential ingredients to become another catalytic case, regardless of whether people actually support Navalny's politics, because this is one of the interesting things. In a way, this is a case of Navalny the man rather than Navalny the politician. So you don't actually need to buy into his vision of the future of Russia or whatever to actually think something is wrong here. So actually, it could well be the one thing that also gets the opposition once again moving closer together. What we saw with the sort of formation of this coordinating council was the very absence of any coordination. It seemed to have shattered the unity of the protest movement, as well as its ability to reach out beyond its own constituency. This might be a case in which, because they see it as a great opportunity, or simply because they think, well, if Navalny goes, any of us can be next, that precisely brings the opposition back together, gives them some clear focus, but also gives them that all-important issue of something that they can reach out to wider constituencies.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned his it not being about his politics, and I mean, I'm not the constituency he's playing to, of course, but, you know, I'm sympathetic to the man, obviously, but yet I'm very uncomfortable with his nationalism. I mean, it's it'd be the first question I'd ask him if I were ever to interview him. I'd like to clarify a lot of this, but that's the one bit of his politics that make me a bit uncomfortable. But at the same time, I find him a very appealing figure. I wanted to kind of go into this martyr syndrome briefly before we move on, because this question was put to him by Moskovsky Komsomolets this week, where they asked him about this, and he answered by saying, "Look, just creating a martyr is not all it's not all it's cracked up to be. Hodorkovsky's been in prison for, you know, almost 10 years now." And yeah, he's a martyr, but he's not going to be president at any time. You know, it's not going to turn into political power. So is the martyr factor overrated, in your opinion?
Yes, I think the martyr factor is the consolation prize. And the martyr factor is something that someone else gets to exploit, use, and define. The interesting thing about Navalny is, I mean, you're absolutely right that his politics maybe haven't had as much scrutiny, or certainly haven't had as much scrutiny, and perhaps are in some ways a little bit more troubling, potentially, than his anti-corruption
campaign. Because they're unclear, actually.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. But, you know, just accept that there is a possibility of something there that might turn people off. But it's in some ways, I mean, I wonder how, well, I'm sure that they're already around Navalny T-shirts. But the same way as, you know, back in the day, many of the people who sported Che Guevara T-shirts were not actually proclaiming their adherence to a Latin American model of socialist revolution. They were instead just simply feeling, A, it was chic, and B, there was that general sense that it was, you know, rising up against,
the man.
An aging and corrupt elite and the man and so forth. So too, in that respect, you know, Che Guevara, from that point of view, there was a convenience that he was dead. So no one actually had to think about the man, but it was only about the myth. Well, Navalny has the potential to get it both, to have it both ways, in that something like this can help build his myth as precisely the man whom the authorities were desperate to nail, the man who was actually willing to stand up and fight corruption and so forth, all good heroic stuff. But at the same time, given that I do think it's actually unlikely that he's going to find himself spending 10 years in some hard labor camp in Norilsk. Given that he's probably also in some way or other still going to be active in politics, he gets to be a politician as well. Mm. So, I mean, again, this is problematic. It looks unlikely that they got enough to really be, or else that they're that determined that they're willing to just show trial him and throw away the key. So actually, they're going to give him both martyr status, but also essentially leadership within the opposition, which is something that he's had in principle already, or rather he's been the first among equals. But this may well make him the key dominant figure.
As Anna Akhmatova once said about Joseph Brodsky, what a biography they're creating for him. You'd think he hired them. Before we move on, there's one other thing I wanted to touch on, and that is Navalny and the elite, because he is one of these figures that a lot of the elite is comfortable with. This case is, what potential does this case have to divide the elite? I mean, he didn't land on the Aeroflot board by accident. I mean, he does have sympathizers within the broader elite. And so this isn't just about society, but there are people in the elite that are deeply uncomfortable with this. And could this be a catalyst there as well?
In some ways, it's an interesting case study in the potential power of embarrassment. It might sound like a silly emotion to be bringing into this context, but I do feel that just as with the castling, for many of the elite who may not actually have a personal stake, nonetheless, there are some actions that run counter to how they feel the state ought to be working. The castling was one, and I suspect the Navalny case will be another. That there are people who, you know, they're rich, they're happy, they would rather not be investigated too closely by the tax authorities and such like. But they also have a sense, particularly since they're an almost directly transnational elite these days, you know, they travel abroad. If they're in business, they will have foreign partners and interlocutors and so forth. How Russia is viewed by the outside world matters to them. Mm-hmm. So for all kinds of reasons, I think this is something that they will not be happy with. So you have, on the one hand, people who are genuinely sympathetic towards Navalny. And on the whole, these are not members of the, you know, the upper elite, the deep state and such like. But nonetheless, you know, there are some people who are clearly quite close to that level. Right. But mainly it's in sort of the lower levels of the elite, shall we say.
Mm. Well, I would,
and then there's also other people who don't necessarily support Navalny, but are not comfortable seeing their state do this, both because it's embarrassing and also because, frankly, it's badly done. It's every time the state acts clumsily, then it makes them a little bit more worried about what's going on in the Kremlin.
And Bystrykhin is nothing if not clumsy. All right, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the increasingly tight relationship between television and law enforcement in Russia. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Здравствуйте, полиция.
Так.
Защитники, видимо, чего-то опасаясь, просят прессу покинуть помещение.
Мы вас не пропускаем. Мы не хотим, чтобы вы снимали. Мы имеем на это полное право.
Whether it's riot police bursting into an out-of-favor official's home in Novgorod, or investigators searching the homes of opposition leaders in Moscow, it's a scene we've seen dozens of times. It always happens early in the morning, the targets are usually asleep, and the TV cameras are always rolling. Viewers are then fed a breathless report about the latest exploits of Russia's fearless investigators. Television, it appears, has become a virtual adjunct of law enforcement in Russia. Sometimes it appears that this ongoing ninja show is just as important as the cases themselves, from raids broadcast in real time to so-called documentaries chronicling the dirty deeds of the Kremlin's chosen villain of the moment. Mark, let's cut right to it. What's the point of all this? What are the authorities trying to achieve with this TV law enforcement nexus? And, you know, Novaya Gazeta actually published a list of to show the TV people that have been at practically every one of these raids. And how successful is this? So what's the goal and are they achieving it?
I think the goal is twofold. One is hopefully to show the targets in a bad light, which tends to imply, you know, showing that they have these glorious apartments full of money and gaudy trinkets and such like, which, of course, can rebound, as we mentioned, with Navalny. So the first thing is actually it's meant to try and sort of on an emotional level prejudge the issue. The second thing, it's an interesting concept about the whole theater of law enforcement. That to an extent we used to. I mean, there are all kinds of rituals. There's frankly almost a ritual to how organized crime killings tend to be reported as well. But in this respect, the theater's value is precisely to make people have a sense that they know how the story is going to go. You know, we are all products, alas, of the television age, and used to all the tropes of that. Well, likewise, I think there is that sense of, well, you want to create a situation in which, you know, when you get the footage, you have your moment of titillation seeing inside someone else's house. Then you actually have that sense of seeing someone hopefully, you know, in tears or embarrassed or just in some ways discomforted by the forces of the state. And then you know how this is going to play out. You know that they're going to be found guilty of something. You know that they're on their downfall. It's almost an attempt to precisely condition the public opinion. The trouble is that it doesn't always work, and especially, again, it depends on being able to handle the theatre very well. And we've talked in the past about actually that the Kremlin has lost its stage management finesse. And I can't help thinking, let's draw the parallel with TV series, long-running TV series. On the whole, they tend to have to steadily become more themselves than ever before. The explosions have to be bigger, the conspiracies have to be deeper, and so forth. You know, if last season you foiled a plot to blow up the world, then, you know, this season you're in trouble. And I think there is a problem in that respect, because I think what happens is the authorities have created their own little sort of, you know, TV series in effect. But the trouble is, for that to work, it has to be continually not just reiterative, but raising its game every time. And then they're not doing that.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is not unique to Russia, but of course it has a Russian twist. I mean, Americans of my generation grew up watching a show called Dragnet. It was a police show, but it was always based on true stories, and it would start, the story you're about to see is true, the names have been changed to protect the innocent, right? And when you were watching it, though, you knew you were watching about a case that was already done. You knew the people, the bad guys were guilty in this case. The difference here is it's not a dramatization, it's happening in real time, and it's presuming guilt from the very get-go. Along those lines, what about these documentaries? Now, these always seem to preclude an actual investigation. So you'll have a NTV documentary, which has begun to be called Cop TV in Russia because it has so many of these things. But you'll have an NTV documentary about whatever, Udaltsov, Razvozhayev, Navalny, what have you, the anatomy of protest, all of this. And then right after the documentary, you'd have a criminal case. Is the tail wagging the dog here? Is this part of the police procedure to begin with a television documentary now? Is this because I really don't think the Russian police are just picking up on the investigative work of gumshoe Russian investigative journalists. That is clearly not what's happening here. But has this television aspect in these, not in the raids, but in these more complicated criminal cases that they've tried to concoct, is the TV element a part of the whole process now?
Definitely. I think this is it. It's certainly not the case that it's a random coincidence, right, or similar.
We're just investigating what these journalists dug up. That's
yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I think it is clear that this is a strategy in its own terms. And a phenomenally unsubtle and, I think, ultimately unsuccessful one. But again, it's part and parcel of the new Kremlin. And in some ways, I mean, to be honest, I would put it very much back. It's a Soviet type tactic.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking of, and again, you know, in pre-TV, pre-glitz and so forth age, when Yuri Andropov was positioning himself to become general secretary, you know, the late Brezhnev era, you had a series of high-profile corruption cases, particularly one General Tsvigun, who's linked to Brezhnev's son-in-law, Churbanov. And, you know, both through informal and formal channels, or, you know, definitely the word was leaked about the assets, the property, the ill-gotten gains that they collected. And it was meant to fulfill two functions. One is to undermine the target, and more to the point, you know, in that process, the whole Brezhnev clan. But at the same time, to tell the Soviet people that, you know, we know there's corruption, but don't worry, the KGB is onto it. The KGB will look after you. Now, I don't know how well that worked at the time, except certainly in terms of undermining the Brezhnev clan, it did its political job there. But nowadays, you know, obviously it's now in a very, very different kind of format. It's glitzy, it's televisual and so forth. But I think the intent is still the same. It's one, to prejudge the case of your target. And secondly, an attempt to try and reassure the Russians that actually their current leaders are the best bet, because those people who are against them are bad people, one and all. The trouble is, I think it's proving very, very unsuccessful at that, in part precisely because of the multiplicity of different sources that Russians have at their disposal. You know, it's not as though you now have control over the media message, and apart from people who manage to sort of get past the jamming and listen to RFERL or BBC or whatever, they don't know, you know, any other story. Right. Nowadays, NTV is a competitor. And again, I think this is one of the things, I think it's one of the reasons why they go so extreme, is because they are basically competing in a market of often very gaudy and extreme television. So it's a strategy, it's just not a very good one.
And this is nothing, again, it's become more gaudy and more loud and more crazy lately. But I remember in the 90s working as a reporter in Russia, and this would happen, but it would be a lot more, it would be a little surprisingly more subtle then. I mean, if somebody was going to be targeted with a corruption investigation, I specifically remember when St. Petersburg Mayor Anatoly Sobchak was being targeted by his enemies, and you'd get little leaks in the press. You know, did Sobchak accept a bribe? I remember that headline actually prior to a case being opened, which was driven by Alexander Kozhikov, who was Yeltsin's security guru at the time. Anyway, it was done that way, but you didn't have these bells and whistles, Hollywood style, dramatic, TV so-called documentaries. So the game has changed a little bit. Now, you mentioned the Andropov thing, and that's interesting because to me, the target of that campaign was the elite. Andropov was trying to position himself to be general secretary, and that the obvious target of any such campaign was not the public, but the elite. There was kind of collateral benefit, if you will, with the public. The KGB is on the case fighting corruption. Now, are they targeting just the public or the elite with these media dramas?
I think that actually the media drama aspect of it is essentially the public. I find it hard to believe that the elite are particularly influenced by them, except insofar as it's a signal.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, look, it's time to distinguish yourself from so-and-so because they're next on our hit list.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I don't think it has a major impact in terms of elite politics. Instead, I think it is much more geared towards the public because precisely we are now in an age which, however imperfectly, Russia is a democracy. And therefore, at the very least, you want to try and ensure that you don't sort of find yourself in a position where you're going to have to completely rewrite the electoral statistics when it comes down to it. And I think that the point is the Kremlin is aware of its crisis of legitimation. And therefore, I think, you know, this is, in this respect, it's part of this wider campaign of Putin's to try and come up with a new vision of Putin. And one of them is precisely to tell the Russian public, don't worry, we know that the boyars have got a bit out of hand. I'm the guy who's going to control them. And in this context, I think it's part and parcel. It's almost trying to ensure that there is no viable pole around which the public can assemble their views other than Putin. Higher members of the elite, well, we know they're corrupt. Even members of the apparent opposition, well, they're corrupt too. Ultimately, there is only one man in whom you can put your trust, and that is clearly Putin. Again, I think it's not a strategy that's going to work, but it does seem to be emerging as part of Putin's new look, is to ensure that from the point of view of the public, he reacquires this pivotal function. And to that extent, you know, up to this point, my view has been that the problem with the Kremlin has been drift and a sort of a growing elite disgruntlement and concern about that. This actually begins to smack more of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm beginning to wonder if actually I've underrated just how worried the Kremlin is about the current situation.
I think they're terrified right now. I mean, I frankly think they're terrified. To bring the podcast full circle, let's put these two things together because we're about to see this spectacle I'm not going to call it the trial of the century, but we have to say that this Navalny trial that's coming up is a big deal, as Vice President Biden might say. but it's going to be taking place within this spectacle that we're just describing here. With the Kremlin attacks using the traditional media and as an adjunct of law enforcement, and with the counterattacks on social media from the opposition, what do you expect to see here? I mean, I know it's a pretty amorphous question, but what do you expect to? How do you anything you expect
Yes, well, I mean, in many ways, it may not be the trial of the century, but probably is going to be the trial of the decade in terms of defining what's going to happen in the rest of the decade. Now, in terms of what I expect to see here, I feel I should channel Kirill and say, you know, I'm not a fortune teller. I mean, I think, actually, the surprise is going to be precisely that there's going to be no surprises. I would be very skeptical that the state has some new bit of evidence to pull out or whatever. I think they're going to rely essentially on a supine court and lots of smear and innuendo to push through whatever court judgment they want. And in the process, that will allow Navalny all kinds of options to present himself to a wider public. I mean, it's interesting, a figure that we've scarcely mentioned of late, though you touched on him before, Udaltsov. Mm-hmm. We've also just heard that his period of incommunicado and house arrest has been extended. And precisely, who's heard of Udaltsov? I mean, think of these two methods. I mean, okay, he and Navalny were both, very different politicians and so forth. But nonetheless, they also show two different strategies. Udaltsov, silence. Navalny, try and sort of basically destroy. Udaltsov at the moment is essentially still nowhere. Navalny now has a platform. So, I mean, I think we're going to see him probably actually at least trying to give the impression that he's enjoying the court case. Making the most possible mileage he can. And doing something, I think, again, unless the authorities back down, I think this is something that will be leveraged internationally far, far more effectively than Pussy Riot, even though Pussy Riot had a certain sort of, three punkette girl singers sort of allure. But, this is something that's going to be seriously discussed around the world.
So they've created possibly a very big opportunity here for Mr. Navalny.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Unfortunately, is all we have time for today, but I'm sure we'll be returning to this theme in the future. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. On the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, Mark.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.